content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading this week from the January 25th, 2019 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows a rendition of the wall, or what's now being called a steel barrier. It has the effect of a wall, but with kind of steel slats that you can see through. There's a gentleman with his back turned to us that has just cut out three sections of it with a hacksaw. You can see the hacksaw in his left hand. And on the other side is a Hispanic woman with her two kids, and he's offering her his hand to her for her to come through the cut portion of the wall. The headline is, "Would a wall work? What the evidence shows about the effectiveness of a border barrier." And that story is going to be in our controversy of the week, but we'll start with this main story. Trump's secretive conversations with Putin. What happened? President Trump's relationship with Russia came under fresh scrutiny this week after a pair of media reports raised new questions about the Kremlin's influence on the White House. The New York Times reported that FBI agents were so alarmed by the president's behavior after firing FBI Director James Comey in 2016 that they opened a counterintelligence investigation into whether Trump was knowingly or unwittingly working on behalf of the Russian government. Law enforcement officials were especially concerned by comments Trump made on NBC News and to Russian officials visiting the White House, in which he stated that he had fired Comey over the FBI investigation into Russian election interference. In another blow to the White House, the Washington Post reported the president has gone to extraordinary lengths since he was elected to hide the details of his conversations with Russian President Vladimir Putin from government officials. U.S. officials told the Post that there is no detailed record of any of the five face-to-face meetings Trump has had with Putin, even in classified government files. After a 2017 meeting with Putin in Hamburg, Germany, Trump even took away his interpreter's notes, telling her not to share the details of what was said with other officials. Trump called questions about whether he worked in behalf of Russia insulting, telling reporters, "I never worked for Russia. It's a whole big fat hoax. It's just a hoax." House Democrats vowed to hold hearings to push for more information about Trump's dealings with Putin. "Every time Trump meets with Putin, the country is told nothing," said Representative Elliot Engel, chairman of the House Committee on Foreign Affairs. "The Foreign Affairs Committee will seek to get to the bottom of it." What the editorial said: President Trump's aggressive efforts to conceal his chats with Putin are downright alarming, said the Boston Globe. This is a president who had already triggered an unprecedented FBI investigation into whether he'd been compromised by Russia. Since then, the president's personal obsequiousness toward Putin has done nothing to allay suspicions. Congress should subpoena Trump's translators for their testimony and notes. The American people have an urgent right to know what Trump is telling Putin. "The only thing alarming here is the FBI's actions," said the Wall Street Journal. Senior FBI officials took it upon themselves to investigate Trump after he had fired their incompetent boss, which was entirely within the president's constitutional authority. The FBI's attempt to portray a sitting president as a foreign asset ought to be shocking, not least to civil libertarians and Democrats who profess to be horrified by the legacy of J. Edgar Hoover. What the columnist said: The FBI had no choice, said Tom Nichols in USA Today. In 2016, the Bureau was investigating several Trump associates for their secretive ties to Russia in the aftermath of a massive Kremlin campaign to influence the election in Trump's favor. Then Trump fired the FBI director and bragged to the Russian ambassador that he'd taken the pressure off. Add this to the blackmail possibilities of Trump's 30-year history of business dealings with Russia, and only the most stupid or craven law enforcement agency would decline to investigate. Trump has something to hide. Spare me the conspiracy theories about Trump being a Russian spy, said Mark Thiessen in the Washington Post. The simplest explanation for the president's cagey behavior is that he cannot trust those around him. Details of private conversations with Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull, UK Prime Minister Theresa May, and Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte were all leaked to the press, generating embarrassing headlines. Every president has the right to hold confidential conversations. The evidence for obstruction of justice is very strong, said Renato Mariotto in Politico.com. And there's also mounting evidence of collusion. What really matters is whether Trump committed high crimes and misdemeanors worthy of impeachment. If Special Counsel Robert Mueller can show that President Trump obstructed justice because he was compromised by the Kremlin, that would arguably meet the standard for impeachment. But it's the American people, through their elected representatives in Congress, who will ultimately have to decide. We'll read a second, shorter main story this morning. The growing impact of the shutdown. What happened? President Trump refused to budge this week on his demand for $5.7 billion to fund a border wall, scorning Republican efforts at a compromise to end the longest government shutdown in U.S. history. With Trump threatening to prolong a partial shutdown for months or even years, the federal workforce is increasingly strained. About 800,000 workers are furloughed or working without pay, and each has already lost an average of $5,000 in wages. $200 million in federal wages are going unpaid every day. The Trump administration calls tens of thousands of employees back to work this week to process taxes and inspect aircraft, food, and drugs. Yet tax audits, financial fraud probes, and power plant inspections are on hiatus. National parks operating with skeleton staffs have been trashed, and Houston and Miami airport terminals closed after a surge of TSA workers called in sick. White House economists now project each week of the shutdown cuts quarterly economic growth by 0.13%, double their initial estimate. Democrats are making the shutdown hit close to home for the president. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi told Trump that the January 29th State of the Union address should be postponed. Trump has mulled ways to fund the wall without Congress, including declaring a national emergency, an option he said he'd almost definitely pursue before reversing course and taking it off the table. Regardless, his signature campaign proposal appears non-negotiable. I promised safety and security for the American people, Trump said on Twitter. Elections have consequences. What the columnist said. The wall or nothing camp has brushed aside the plight of federal workers with astounding callousness, said Catherine Rampell in WashingtonPost.com. Republicans love to champion the dignity of work, yet they appear unmoved by reports of unpaid government employees, many of whom make less than $50,000 a year, selling their children's toys on Craigslist, rationing their insulin, and delaying surgeries. It takes two to stalemate, said William McGurn in the Wall Street Journal. Between half and two-thirds of Americans blame Trump for the shutdown, but those same polls show a third to a quarter blaming Pelosi. Don't expect an epic capitulation from either side. It would be too humiliating. But it's equally misguided to think it's only a matter of time before the GOP coalition cracks. Trump and the Democrats are both on the hook. Here's what could make Trump blink, said Noah Smith in Bloomberg.com. The workers affected by the shutdown constitute about 3% of the country's labor force. Recessions usually bring about a 2-4% increase in unemployment. Being furloughed isn't the same as being unemployed, but the macroeconomic spillovers might be comparable. Worse, the shutdown could soon provoke companies to cut investment, which could quickly ripple through the supply chain. Is the wall really worth a recession? And our controversy of the week, border security. Is Trump's wall a realistic solution? What started as an applause line at Donald Trump's 2016 campaign rallies has morphed into one of the dumbest policy debates in the history of American politics, said Christopher Hooks in the Texas Observer. The only reason we're a month into the longest government shutdown in our history is that President Trump fears disappointing the Make America Great Again heads who cheered deliriously when he promised them a big, beautiful wall across the southern border that a humiliated Mexico would pay for. 2 years later, with no wall being built or paid for, he's demanding that Congress authorize $5.7 billion to build a steel fence or something, anything, along our border with Mexico. Not only is Trump's wall opposed by voters 55% to 43%, it would also be an ineffective and wasteful way to address what Trump insists is a crisis of drugs, criminals, and illegal immigrants invading our country. Drug dealers don't lug heroin for days across mountains and deserts. They smuggle it in through the border checkpoints in cars, trucks, and people. The vast majority of migrants showing up at the border today are presenting themselves voluntarily to U.S. authorities and legally requesting asylum. The only value in Trump's wall, in short, is that it's a simple expression of racial resentment to gratify his base. Let's get our facts straight, said Ford O'Connell in TheHill.com. Contrary to liberal caricature, Trump isn't proposing one continuous wall along all 2,000 miles of our southern border. The $5.7 billion would be spent to upgrade and add about 200 miles to the 650 miles of fencing and barriers that are already in place, thanks to the votes of such notorious racists as Senators Barack Obama, Joe Biden, Chuck Schumer, and Hillary Clinton. Such barriers work. The fencing in Yuma, Arizona, constructed with bipartisan support in 2005, produced a 90% drop in illegal traffic in that area. Unfortunately, said Emily Eakins in TheFederalist.com, some of the inconsiderate rhetoric Trump has used about immigrants has racialized the issue of border security. Democrats now oppose a wall only because Trump is for it. The real question is whether a wall would really work, said Jacob Soboroff and Julia Ainsley in NBCNews.com. Trump has settled on a design that features 40-foot-high, sharp-pointed steel slats that he deemed very, very hard to penetrate. But when the Department of Homeland Security tested a prototype of this kind of fence in 2017, it found that the slats could be quickly cut through with a handheld metal cutting saw. Smugglers and migrants are already using sledgehammers, saws, ladders, and other tools to get past existing barriers. All barriers are mere temporary inconveniences to anyone truly determined to enter our country, said Christine Phillips in the Washington Post. The Border Patrol has found hundreds of tunnels, some a half mile long, dug under existing fences to smuggle in people and contraband. So why spend another $5.7 billion for the illusion of border security? If Trump really wanted a wall, said Noah Rothman in NBCNews.com, he could have had $25 billion to build one last year. But he rejected a bipartisan compromise that would have provided a major wall funding in exchange for legal status for 1.8 million Dreamers. Trump killed that deal when immigration hardliners objected to it. For 2 years, Trump and the Republicans who controlled Congress had multiple chances to fund a wall, but they declined on every occasion. That tells you everything you need to know about the need for Trump's signature policy proposal. And we're down to our good week, bad week segment. It was a good week for survivalists with the news that Costco, the bulk food wholesaler, is selling a 27-pound storage bucket of macaroni and cheese with a shelf life of 20 years. The bucket retails for $89.99, which works out to a cost-efficient 50 cents per serving. It was a good week for Romeo, the world's loneliest frog, who may have found a mate. One of the last surviving Sehuenca's water frogs, Romeo spent 10 years alone in a Bolivian aquarium before being introduced to Juliet, a new specimen described as really energetic. And it was a good week for casual dining. After President Trump welcomed the champion Clemson Tigers college football team to the White House with hundreds of boxes of burgers, Filet-O-Fish, and pizzas from McDonald's, Wendy's, Burger King, and Domino's. "Our nutritionists must be having a fit," remarked one Clemson player. But it was a bad week for the childish. After frustrated highway officials at the Washington State Department of Transportation announced they were replacing a constantly stolen 69-mile marker with one nearby reading 68.9 miles. It was a bad week for gratitude with the news that GOP Congressman and former obstetrician Dr. Phil Rowe will be challenged in 2020 by Democrat Chris Rowe, who claims Rowe delivered him as a baby. Rowe says he's running to expand access to health care. And finally, it was a bad week for the rains down in Africa. After artist Max Seidenthoff set up six speakers attached to a solar-powered MP3 player in the Namib Desert to play Africa, the 1982 Toto hit, for all eternity. Seidenthoff said he wanted to pay the song the ultimate homage. And before we leave this page, we'll do the boring but important item. Contraceptive mandate stays in place. Federal courts in California and Pennsylvania this week blocked new rules that would have limited the free access to birth control required by the Affordable Care Act. The Trump administration sought to expand the religious objection exception to the ACA's directive that ensures cover birth control with no copays. Under the new rules, any company could decline to provide contraception coverage as a matter of conscience or religious belief. New Jersey and Pennsylvania had sued, arguing that the planned changes would place too great a financial burden on the states. Philadelphia Judge Wendy Beadlestone issued a nationwide injunction that keeps them from taking effect. She said the new rules are inconsistent with the law. The title of our briefing page article this week is The Growing Crisis in Venezuela. 3 million people have fled imploding Venezuela. How did it get this bad? Why the exodus? Venezuela's economy and social order are collapsing, leaving 75% of the population desperately poor and without sufficient food. The physical currency, the Bolivar, is all but worthless, while the Petro, the new digital currency that socialist President Nicolas Maduro introduced last year, tied to the price of oil, is largely fictitious. The IMF predicts that the country's inflation could reach 10 million% this year. Not that there's much to buy. Store shelves stand empty and soldiers guard warehouses against looters. Most Venezuelans are now protein deprived, and they joke grimly about the Maduro diet that has left adults thin and children malnourished. Hospitals lack medicines and basic supplies, and surgical patients are told to bring their own cleaning products and bandages. The murder rate has soared to 15 times the global average, and crime is rampant. They rob you in the street, on the beach, in the market, at the hospital, said teacher Yamileth Maracano. It's terrible to live like this. What caused the collapse? The radical socialist regime set up by Hugo Chavez worked fine for a few years until it ruined the country. First elected in 1998, Chavez redistributed the country's land and massive oil wealth to benefit the poor, paying for his programs by nationalizing the oil industry, which now accounts for 98% of export earnings, and the banks. But his price controls choked the country's businesses, and by the time Chavez died in 2013, inflation had soared to nearly 50%. Then global oil prices fell dramatically, leaving his successor, Maduro, with a recession that became a crisis. Without the flood of foreign oil dollars flowing in that could be used to buy products, imports dried up and shelves emptied of basic necessities. Meanwhile, the country became a narco state, with many top generals and politicians, including former Vice President Tarek El Aissami, indicted in the U.S. for drug trafficking and money laundering. Rather than addressing these problems pragmatically, the authoritarian Maduro has devoted his energies to suppressing dissent and preventing a coup. How has he survived? Through the raw exercise of power. The opposition won the 2015 parliamentary election and now dominates the National Assembly. But Maduro rammed through changes that eviscerated the Assembly's power. He then created a new constituent assembly, packed with his supporters, to rewrite the Constitution. Under the guise of an anti-corruption sweep, he fired the top Chavez loyalist who might have challenged him, such as former state oil chief Rafael Ramirez, and he jailed charismatic opposition leaders such as Leopoldo López. When the military began grumbling, Maduro purged it brutally. Seven generals who collectively controlled 60% of the troops were arrested last March on conspiracy charges. Not only are intelligence agents detaining and torturing members of the military, said Jose Miguel Vivanco of Human Rights Watch, in some cases, they are also going after their families or other civilians. Why haven't the people risen up? Protests began in earnest in 2014, a year after Maduro took office, and they have flared up ever since. But the regime has violently crushed these demonstrations. Riot police and armed pro-government gangs known as colectivos routinely bludgeon, tear gas, and even shoot demonstrators. Hundreds have been killed and thousands arrested. Last year, there was much less organized resistance, partly because opposition leaders are exiled or jailed, and partly because Venezuelans are mostly focused on getting food and surviving or getting out. Since Maduro took office, nearly 3 million people have emigrated, some 7% of the population. And the exodus is continuing. considering the magnitude of Venezuela's crisis, said Luis Almagro, Secretary General of the Organization of American States. There may be up to 10 million Venezuelans who will have to abandon that country. Where have they gone? More than 1 million are in neighboring Colombia. Another 500,000 are in Peru. And most of the rest have ended up in Ecuador, Argentina, Chile, and Brazil. At first, Colombia reacted to the Venezuelan influx with generosity, offering the migrants work permits and health care. But with some 5,000 people a day leaving Venezuela, border towns simply can't cope. We are experiencing the most outrageous migratory and humanitarian crisis in the region's recent history, Colombian President Iván Duque said at the UN last year. Will other nations step in? After Maduro won a new six-year term last year in a rigged election, 12 Latin American nations, including Colombia and Brazil, said they would not recognize the Maduro administration and have pledged to isolate him. But a military invasion is unlikely. Venezuela still has the backing of socialist ally Cuba, while China has given it loans and Russia has offered military aid. Change will have to come from within. The opposition-controlled National Assembly picked a new leader this year, Juan Guaido, and he vows a new fight. We have plans, Guaido said, to call the people to the streets. And we'll read a few of the best columns of the week. We'll start with why China is winning the space race. The space race didn't end when Neil Armstrong planted an American flag on the moon, said Namrata Goswami. If anything, it's only getting started, and China may be moving into the lead. On January 2nd, it became the first country to land a robotic rover on the moon's far side, the first step in its strategy to become the leading space power by 2045. China's plans for industrializing the moon could make it Earth's dominant power in the 21st century. China seeks to establish an industrial and logistical base on the moon, allowing it to mine a huge trove of titanium, platinum, and other precious metals, and to launch missions deeper into space, including to Mars. Space travel is currently limited by the unavailability of in-orbit rocket fuel, which requires water. The lunar poles likely contain hundreds of millions of tons of water, and China plans on sending robotic prospectors there by 2030. 50 years ago, the race to the moon was a symbolic contest between democracy and communism. Today, the U.S. has largely retreated from space, with no specific national goals and very limited funding. With its well-coordinated, disciplined, technocratic system, China is well-positioned to win the next space race. This column comes from Italy. No more feeding the strays. Rome's journey toward modernity comes at the sacrifice of the cat ladies, said Gianluca Nicoletti. The Gattare, as the mostly elderly women are known, have long been a fixture in Rome, lovingly placing plates of table scraps out for the roughly 200,000 cats that wander our ancient city. No more. City officials have decreed that henceforth only special guardians authorized by the regional health service will be allowed to feed the strays, and they will serve up only leftovers from public cafeterias. It all sounds very clinical in contrast to the mystical liturgy of the cat ladies. For a Gattara, there was no other religion than the cult of the cats. She was their queen and at the same time the most humble of maids. She knew every individual member of her adopted colony, calling each feline by name and choosing a menu according to a careful evaluation of the tastes and needs of her charges. And Agatara did not love only the beautiful. The blinded cat, the crippled cat, the mangy cat with no tail or the severed ear, these were the objects of her ministrations. Will these new faceless bureaucrats take such pains? With the abolition of the Gatara, Rome has just become a little more ruthless. And finally, a column from Saudi Arabia. Women deserve equal rights. It's time for Saudi Arabia to abolish the wrong and discriminatory practice of male guardianship, said Faisal Abbas. The system, which requires women to get a male relative's permission to work, travel abroad, or even leave the house, didn't become codified until the Islamic revival of the 1980s. And today, many Saudi men, even conservatives like me, find it outdated. Our society is now undergoing massive and rapid changes in line with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's Vision 2030 plan for the future. Not only are women now allowed to drive, they have also been granted the right to work in almost all sectors. In most public places, segregation of the sexes is ending. For the first time in 35 years, cinemas are opening. Even our dress code has become far more relaxed. Women can choose for themselves whether to wear the face covering niqab, the hair covering hijab, or neither. Critics may cavil that Saudi feminist activists who advocated for the lifting of the driving ban were jailed last year. But if the security forces acted improperly, I am fully confident that they will face justice. The signs are clear. Whatever is left of the male guardianship system will be abolished by default sooner rather than later. And we will take a look at the last word, our in-depth article this week titled, The Secret War Behind Amazon Reviews. In Amazon's enormous marketplace, sellers will use every dirty trick to get the top spot in searches, said Josh Zazia in TheVerge.com. Their best weapon? Amazon's own impenetrable bureaucracy. Last August, Zach Plansky woke to find that the rifle scopes he was selling on Amazon had received 16 five-star reviews overnight. Usually that would be a good thing, but the reviews were strange. The scope would normally get a single review a day, and many of these referred to a different scope, as if they'd been cut and pasted from elsewhere. I didn't know what was going on, whether it was a glitch or whether somebody was trying to mess with us, Plansky says. As a precaution, he reported the reviews to Amazon. Most of them vanished days later, problem solved, and Plansky reimmersed himself in the work of running a 6-employee, multi-million-dollar weapons accessory business on Amazon. Then, 2 weeks later, the trap was sprung. You have manipulated product reviews on our site, an email from Amazon read. This is against our policies. As a result, you may no longer sell on Amazon.com, and your listings have been removed from our site. A rival had framed Plansky for buying 5-star reviews, a high crime in the world of Amazon. The funds in his account were immediately frozen, and his listings were shut down. Getting his store back would take him on a surreal weeks-long journey through Amazon's bureaucracy, one that began with the click of a button at the bottom of his suspension message that read, Appeal Decision. When you buy something on Amazon, the odds are you aren't buying it from Amazon at all. Plansky is one of 6 million sellers on Amazon Marketplace, the company's third-party platform. They are largely hidden from customers, but behind any item for sale, there could be dozens of sellers, all competing for your click. This year, marketplace sales were almost double those of Amazon retail itself, according to Marketplace Pulse, making the seller platform alone the largest e-commerce business in the U.S. For sellers, Amazon is a quasi-state. They rely on its infrastructure, its warehouses, shipping network, financial systems, and portal to millions of customers and pay taxes in the form of fees. They also live in terror of its rules, which often change and are harshly enforced. A cryptic email like the one Plansky received can send a seller's business into bankruptcy with few avenues for appeal. Amazon's judgments are so severe that its own rules have become the ultimate weapon in the constant warfare of marketplace. Sellers devise all manners of intricate schemes to frame their rivals, as Plansky experienced. They impersonate, copy, deceive, threaten, sabotage, and even bribe Amazon employees for information on their competitors. What are sellers to do when they end up in Amazon court? They can turn to someone like Cynthia Stein, who is part of a growing industry of consultants who help sellers navigate the ruthless world of marketplace and the Byzantine rules by which Amazon governs it. Stein runs a 25-person company out of the den of her one-story house in a leafy neighborhood of Dallas. Her company deals with about 100 suspensions a month and charges $2,500 per appeal, or $5,000 if you want an expedited one. Each day, sitting before dual monitors and jotting notes on her tablet, Stein takes calls from distraught sellers who have received the dreaded email from Amazon. On her walls, photos of her family and families of her support staff in the Philippines, a pegboard with packing tape and shipping labels, vestiges of her past life as an Amazon seller, and a sign that says, "Coffee, until it's time for wine." She calls the scheme that got Plansky's a dirty seller trick, and she's seen it before. As Amazon has escalated its war on fake reviews, sellers have realized that the most effective tactic is not buying them for yourself, but buying them for your competitors. The more obviously fraudulent, the better. A handful of glowing testimonials, preferably in broken English about unrelated products and written by a known review purveyor on Fiverr, can not only take out a competitor and allow you to move up a slot in Amazon search results, it can land your rival in the bewildering morass of Amazon's suspension system. And Stein's team had bad news. The only way back from suspension is to confess and repent, she says, even if you don't think you've done anything wrong. Amazon doesn't like to see finger pointing. Amazon calls them appeals, which suggests that there's a possibility of having the verdict overturned. In reality, they're more like a plea bargain, crossed with a business memo, the core of which is a plan of action, an explanation of how you'll make things right. And to make things right, you need to admit to having done something wrong. So Plansky sat down with Stein's team and looked for something, anything, to confess to. In his appeal, he admitted to providing discounts for reviews before Amazon banned the practice and to sending customers emails about printing out shooting targets that the algorithm might have mistaken for bribes. "It was crazy," he said. "I felt like I was in prison for a crime I didn't commit, and the only way out was to plead guilty." In a way, Plansky had it easy. He at least knew what he had to confess to, even if he hadn't done it. Many sellers can't even figure out what Amazon is accusing them of. Stein has a client whose listing for a rustic barn wood picture frame was deemed unsafe and taken down. It turned out that the offense was a single customer review that mentioned getting a splinter. The customer had actually given it 5 stars. The seller was allowed back when he promised to add "wear gloves when installing" to his listing. Another seller was suspended for selling Nike shoes that were not as described after he'd filed appeal after appeal proving the shoes were genuine Nikes, Stein's team figured out the problem. Some buyers complained the shoes were too small. That seller was let back on after promising to add a line that the listing recommending that customers wear thin socks. That's what we call speaking Amazon, Stein says. In my mind, I imagine a checklist, and it doesn't even have to make sense. It's just that the previous appeals hadn't included this all-important proactive step they were going to take to prevent the complaint that the shoe was too tight. J.C. Hewitt, whose law firm frequently works with Amazon sellers, calls the system's mandatory guilty pleas, arbitrary verdicts, and obscure language a Kafkaesque bureaucracy with bad writing. Inscrutable rulings emerge as if from a black box. The performance team, which handles suspensions, has no phone number. There's no one to ask for clarification. The only way to interact with them is by filing an appeal. And when it's rejected, sellers often have no idea why. The secrecy can be so frustrating that sellers have traveled to Seattle or Amazon's London office to try to find a human to no avail. One seller flew to Seattle from Xingzhou, China, and lived out of a Honda Pilot he bought on Craigslist while he wandered around Amazon's offices trying to find someone to hear his case. The receptionist gave him the same phone number for seller support he'd been trying for weeks. Plansky had reported the fake five-star reviews as soon as he'd gotten them, and after he was suspended, he'd played by Amazon's rules and confessed to everything that could possibly have considered review manipulation. But in the end, it wasn't enough. Several days after filing his appeal, he received an email saying it had been rejected. Amazon won't read the same appeal twice, so now Plansky has to find another infraction to confess to. Unable to think of anything and utterly exasperated, he and Stein's team decided to email Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos, a last resort. Once you've gone to Jeff, there's nowhere else to go, Stein says. Emailing the richest man in the world is actually the standard method of escalating an Amazon seller appeal. It's called a Jeff bomb, or as Stein prefers, a Jeff letter. Dear Mr. Bezos, they wrote, we desperately need your help. It's probably not Bezos reading the emails, though one former employee who is now a consultant to sellers said that during his time at Amazon, he was forwarded several appeals with only a question mark written on them, a signal of Bezos' displeasure. Generally, fortunate sellers will have a member of Bezos' staff take pity and respond. Plansky's Jeff letter was never answered, but after he'd sent it, a fellow Amazon seller at a local meetup gave him the name of someone high up in the company. He emailed them, and shortly afterward, he got his account back. Stein maintains that it was the Jeff letter that did it. All told, he estimates his suspension cost him about $150,000 in sales. In the intensely competitive world that Amazon has built, any efforts by the company to clean up seller misbehavior are quickly turned into weapons for sellers to wield against competitors. The crackdown on fake five-star reviews began the five-star bomb Plansky was hit with. After hoverboards started exploding in 2016 and Amazon became more vigilant about safety claims, sellers started buying one another's products, setting them on fire, and posting photos in the reviews. The viciousness of this competition can be surprising, given the items being fought over. But Amazon's scale changes the traditional dynamics of counterfeiting. Rather than knock off a luxury good, it can be lucrative to go after the mundane commodities people buy every day without much thought. USB cables, cutlery organizers, various extruded plastic things. Stein has a client whose shoe tree business was barraged with phony infringement claims, hijackings, and threatening phone calls that she ended up referring to the FBI. surveying crib cushions and safety locks in Amazon's baby category, Stein sees a world of chaos and conflict. All of these sweet little products are definitely potential targets, she says. We tell people, whenever you're successful on the Amazon, you have a target on your back. For most sellers and a growing number of traditional businesses, Amazon is so big, so much the default place people go to shop, that they find ways to tolerate constant sabotage as just another cost of doing business. When sellers get in trouble for customer complaints or attacks from counterfeiters, the solution is often to more fully meld with Amazon, to enroll in its fulfillment program, to purchase Amazon's labels, and to make sure product isn't being diverted, or even make their brand exclusive to Amazon, which brings special protections. Revenue from seller commissions and other fees is growing far faster than Amazon's online sales overall. For Stein, too, business is booming, and she says Amazon has been a force for good in her life. She uses it constantly for everything from groceries to appliances. As we're speaking, she gets a Kindle alert for a new James Patterson novel. Selling on Amazon's platform got her out of a tight spot. She published books about Amazon selling using Amazon's tools. Now she's built a business interpreting its rules and systems, and she's flying around the world to speak at gatherings of Amazon sellers. She thinks the company will only grow, that it will expand its business supply marketplace, providing coffee to offices and machinery to factories, and that one day we'll wake up and it will be like Demolition Man, says Stein, a sci-fi fan where Sylvester Stallone's character comes out of hibernation to find every restaurant is Taco Bell. She recently learned that Amazon may make seller consultants like her a part of the site. She doesn't know exactly what it will look like yet. Maybe a list of Amazon-approved finance, advertising, and other support services on the seller dashboard. But she's eager to join. She's done several interviews explaining her business already, even flying to Seattle of her own volition to meet with Amazon representatives. She's also wary. She knows how Amazon works, and she's given the company a lot of data about her business. I figure I'm going to get everything I can out of it while the getting's good, she says, reaching for another sci-fi reference. I mean, it's like the Borg. Someday we will all be assimilated. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in TheVerge.com. We'll head over to the Talking Points page to round out the hour, starting with an article titled, Capitalism, a Conservative's Surprising Critique. You know you're living in extraordinary times when Tucker Carlson is the most incisive public critic of capitalism in the United States, said Matthew Walter in TheWeek.com. In a remarkable monologue on the state of American conservatism, the Fox News host denounced the Republican Party for its cult-like obsession with the free market. Unbridled capitalism, Carlson argues, has done as much as anything to destroy traditional families. While outsourcing, free trade, and private equity have made a small percentage of urban elites spectacularly wealthy, the same forces have gutted entire communities and left the working class in ruins. Unable to earn enough to support a family, American men are dying in record numbers from drug addiction and suicide. Marriage rates are plummeting as marriage becomes a luxury enjoyed by the affluent. Payday lenders are the biggest businesses in many struggling communities. Nor has consumer culture made us happier. Does anyone still believe that cheaper iPhones or more Amazon deliveries of plastic garbage from China are going to make us happy? Carlson asks. It's a very good question. As Carlson says, Anyone who thinks the health of a nation can be summed up in GDP is an idiot. It's true that something is seriously amiss in American life, said David French in the National Review. But Carlson's victimhood populism wrongly blames the free market for our nation's ills. The tectonic changes of the modern age, including technology, globalization, the sexual revolution, and increasing secularization, have disrupted our economy and our culture. But blaming these changes on a cabal of heartless, money-worshipping elites is silly. Personal choices play a major role in what ails us. It's simply not true, as Carlson claims, that manufacturing jobs are gone. In fact, there are hundreds of thousands of open factory positions that aren't being filled simply for want of qualified applicants. Marriage is under assault, but that's largely the result of individual decisions. Poor Americans who choose to get married and form families have a much higher chance of reaching the middle class. It's wrong to tell Americans they are helpless victims of banks, rich capitalists, and the government, and that their choices have nothing to do with their lot in life. There are wounds that public policy can't heal. Individual responsibility is important, said Timothy Carney in Washington Examiner. But many of my fellow conservatives overstate our ability to determine our own outcomes. The circumstances in which you're born and raised matter a lot. That's why middle and upper class parents are so eager to live in good neighborhoods and get their kids into good schools and provide them with lessons in sports, music, and art. That's why we do everything possible to maximize the odds that they can grow up as happy and successful adults. But to the poor and working class, we say, hey, losers, you and your kids should pull yourself up by the bootstraps. In a country where good blue-collar jobs are scarce, housing is extremely expensive, and the culture and amoral profit seekers are luring kids into many kinds of self-destructive behavior, that's become a lot harder. Historically, conservatives have actively promoted the traditional virtues Carlson espouses, said Ross Douthat in the New York Times. But in recent decades, they've thrown up their hands at the idea that government should do anything about protecting families from, say, rampant pornography, the internet, legal gambling, or the skyrocketing cost of child care. Why not at least try? If conservatives do not offer their own paternalistic policy solutions, desperate Americans will eventually turn to socialism. That shouldn't mean embracing anti-capitalist claptrap, said Timothy Sandifer in Reason. Free markets and affordable imports have raised the standards of living for everyone, making the average American 90 times richer than the average human being. Just consider those cheap iPhones that Carlson derides. Nobody can calculate the hours saved thanks to driving directions features, the lives saved through quick access to 911, or the millions of simple, happy conversations that screen time or text messaging makes possible for families separated by long distances. Freedom is the key word here, said Jonah Goldberg in National Review. Carlson says the free market is just a tool. You could say the same thing about speech or firearms. But speech and gun ownership are rights guaranteed in our nation's founding document, which enshrines personal liberty as America's distinguishing characteristic. Is Carlson suggesting that a conservative nanny state replace the liberal nanny state he used to rail against? The new right-wing anti-market populists are going to need to do a lot more thinking about what they are actually advocating here. And time for a few of the shorter notes, starting with new data shows that the $1.5 trillion tax cut bill is not paying for itself, as its Republican backers predicted it would. Although the economy grew by almost 3% in 2018, federal tax revenues fell by 2.7%, or about $83 billion. The federal budget deficit is now on track to top $1 trillion this year. There were 3.85 million American babies born in 2017, the lowest number since 1987. Only South Dakota and Utah had birth rates high enough to sustain their current populations. A rare Lincoln head penny made of bronze was auctioned off last week for an estimated $140,000. The coin, dubbed the Holy Grail of Mint Errors, is one of 20 the U.S. government accidentally minted in 1943 when it was trying to conserve the metal for shell casings during World War II. Pennies at the time were supposed to be made of zinc-coated steel. Last year, 25 abortion clinics closed in the U.S., leaving 755 abortion clinics nationwide. The number of providers has declined for six straight years, falling by nearly 160 since 2012. Americans age 65 and older were the most likely Facebook users to share fake news articles during the 2016 election, according to a study published in the journal Science Advances. Older people posted seven times as many articles from the fake news websites as did adults 29 and younger. On the poll watch, 49% of Republicans say building a border wall should be a top priority for Congress, up from 43% in December. Among Democrats, gun control and health care reform were top priorities at 43% each. For independents, cutting the deficit and health care reform are the top priorities at 38 and 36% respectively. And we'll finish with a quote from Hunter S. Thompson, quoted in The Atlantic. He says, "Fiction is a bridge to the truth that the mechanics of journalism can't reach." With that, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138.